Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's November 4th. Sign-in sheet is going around, and we're getting some experts in the class to see how to turn the projectors on, but we got those really fancy projectors. I can't get them to turn on. So let's proceed a little bit. So I'll first ask, are there any questions? Anybody have any questions? We were talking about a couple of processes last time. We looked at an antibody antigen reaction having to do with blood that produced transfusion reactions. What's the term for that? When a transfusion reaction happens, how would you describe that mechanism in just one word? It's an antibody antigen reaction. It is agglutination. Very good. Agglutination is it. All right, so we've got to remember that agglutination is antibody antigen. Where do you find the antigens at? On the cell membrane of red blood cells. That's right. And where are antibodies located? They're dissolved in the plasma, right? So they're soluble proteins. And if you were to look at an antibody, what kind of shape does it have? It kind of looks like a little man floating in there, right, with his arms up in the air, and his hands are the receptors, right? And how would you explain binding of a receptor to its particular ligand? It's very specific, that's right. And why is it specific? What has to match up? It is determined by the shape of the receptor site and the shape of the ligand, right? It has to be complementary, and you can use the lock and key model maybe to describe that. So antigens have a specific shape, right? And the antibody has to have the complementary specific shape to bind that particular antigen on the cell surface. All right, then lastly, in lecture last time, we looked at how blood undergoes hemostasis. What's hemostasis? What's that term hemostasis mean? It's the prevention of blood loss, right? Because blood is a connective tissue, but it's kind of a fancy connective tissue in that it is fluid. I don't know another fluid connective tissue. So that when you damage a blood vessel, come on in. It just flows right out of that blood vessel, and of course you need to have proper blood in your blood vessels for it to flow. So there's got to be mechanisms. There are two mechanisms for preventing blood loss. One is good for microscopic tears. What did we call that? Platelet plug formation. All right, that's produced by the platelet forming plugs. All right, and then for major damage to blood vessels, what's the process? Would you call it agglutination? Fibrin formation, yeah. And what is the one word name for fibrin formation?
Coagulation.
Yes, coagulation. Coagulation. All right, so coagulation is fibrin formation. So you see there's a big difference between agglutination and coagulation. One is an antibody antigen reaction, and the other is fibrin formation. All right, so how does fibrin get formed? What's the most immediate precursor to fibrin formation? Is when fibrinogen gets converted into fibrin, right? So there is a soluble protein in blood called fibrinogen. Oh, this is good. This is good. Something is turning on. And if it would be too embarrassing for you to tell me what I did wrong in front of everybody, you could talk to me later. But if you could tell me right now, that would be really good. Oh, so you just did a wireless. Okay, I'll remember that to back that up. Cool. Yeah, thanks very much. Hey, give me a hand. Hey. Okay, so it is coming in. So the slide should be the same, the way I have them on this projector right here. So you can look at either one. All right, I'm not going to be fancy. And that might be about as dark as that one gets, or as bright as that one gets. So what I will do is cut some of the lights down in the room, maybe not that many. Okay, how's that? Is it better with them all the lights off? It's better with them all off, huh? But can you write notes? No, huh? No. No. Okay. This is what we'd like. All right, so let's get back talking about coagulation. Okay? And you notice that that coagulation process, as a matter of fact, we can go back a couple of slides, all right, was this big complicated scheme right here with that extrinsic pathway, intrinsic pathway, all right, with, oops, that's interesting. Okay, let's see if I can stabilize that screen right here. All right, but what do you notice? That these steps are linked together by mostly enzymatic activations, right? And so, for instance, when thrombin, which is an enzyme, works on fibrinogen, converting it into fibrin, what happens to thrombin? Does it become inactivated in the process of that reaction? No, because it's an enzyme. What happens to an enzyme through the process of catalyzing that particular reaction? What happens to an enzyme? Well, nothing, right? Yeah, the enzyme doesn't change, so it can catalyze the reaction over and over and over and over and over again, right? So every time there is this enzymatic reaction in a cascade, it acts as a level of what? Amplification, and it speeds up the process. So that's really what I want you to appreciate in this diagram right here, right? It's a cascade mechanism, and it's a cascade mechanism so that blood can coagulate in a hurry when a blood vessel is damaged. The other thing I want you to appreciate, that there is a positive feedback loop. The formation of thrombin causes the creation of more thrombin because, right, it can activate factor 11 right here. Right, and then factor 11 feeds back in a positive way to convert more prothrombin into thrombin. All right, so prothrombin is a proenzyme, which means it is inactive and it can become activated by prothrombin activator, which is factor 10. All right, the other thing that you should visualize is that there is an ion that is very important for both the extrinsic and intrinsic pathway right here that is necessary for fibrin formation. And what ion is that? Calcium. That has to be present as well. So that's another important reason to have proper levels of calcium in your body. And that this coagulation process is a three-step process. First, prothrombin activator has to be formed. Then thrombin has to be formed. And then when thrombin forms, of course, then fibrin is formed from fibrinogen. So fibrinogen is the soluble protein. And what can you tell me about fibrin? Is it soluble in water? No, it precipitates out, forming that network that traps red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets. Okay, so that's the most important thing. Usually, when we talk about interrupting this process because maybe it is enhanced to such a high degree in some patients that it causes problems in that they can generate blood clots where you shouldn't have blood clots in their circulatory system, that they have to take medications that are anticoagulants, anticoagulation therapy. Maybe they have atrial fibrillation or something, which is a part of the atrium is the, what, the part of the superior part of the heart up by the base. And whenever blood stops flowing, when blood stops flowing, then it has a tendency to coagulate. And those patients have to be on anticoagulation therapy. All right, so what in everyday language, how do people talk about anticoagulation therapy? As blood thinners, okay? And that always really grates on my nerves, and hopefully it will grate on your nerves as well, because when somebody is taking a blood thinner, does their blood get any thinner? Does it get more fluid? Not really, right? It interrupts this process of that coagulation pathway. So it's not really a blood thinner, but it works through different mechanisms depending on what kind of anticoagulant they're taking. There are anticoagulants that you can use in test tubes, but not in people. Yeah? Yeah, an anticoagulant. They tend to do what? Oh, sure. Okay, because it's difficult to titrate the exact amount of inhibition on coagulation. You can't just dial it up like the volume on your car. And it's affected by diet and various kinds of activities. So anybody that's even taking aspirin, aspirin is an anticoagulant because it blocks platelets. I think we showed you that slide last time too. that they'll be more susceptible to vascular damage, right? So their clotting function will be depressed. Yeah, so they're going to bruise more easily. Yeah. So for instance, if you're going to be doing something really wild, like going to some, where would be a really wild place? Well, say you're going to sail from here to Hawaii on a sailboat. All right, so you might be prone to some kinds of injuries doing that, right? And under those circumstances, you might actually wish to cut back a little bit on your anticoagulation therapy if you're doing that. If you're taking an aspirin, stop taking that aspirin because you're going to be away from medical help, right, for maybe a couple weeks at a time, and that would be terrible if something happens because you're more prone to hemorrhage at that time. All right, so in a test tube, right, we can prevent coagulation by getting rid of calcium ions, right? That's a necessary ion. And there are calcium chelators that can bind up calcium and take it out of solution, like EDTA or sodium citrate. Now, we can't prescribe sodium citrate or EDTA for a person because what will it do? It will get rid of all of the calcium in their blood, and what would happen? Synaptic transmission would go away. Muscle contraction would go away. Right, any kind of clotting function would disappear as well, so we can't use that in a person, right? But if we want to stop coagulation in a test tube, then that's a perfect choice. Heparin, right, activates antithrombin 3, so that blocks the action of thrombin. What's thrombin necessary for? The conversion of fibrinogen into fibrin, right? So heparin is a very good anticoagulant. It doesn't thin the blood at all, but it prevents, right, that last step in coagulation, which is the formation of fibrin. Coumarin blocks clotting by inhibiting activation of vitamin K, and vitamin K indirectly works by reducing calcium availability for clotting function. All right, and vitamin K, what can you tell me about vitamin K? Anybody know anything about vitamin K? Okay. It means vitamin right here. That means your body can't produce this biological, it's an organic compound. You have to have vitamin K in your diet. And the source for that is green leafy vegetables, like broccoli, for instance. All right, so just having the proper diet will give you proper clotting function. But that also means that if your diet can influence the therapeutic regimen of coumarin. If you're on coumarin and you change your diet, then that's going to change your clotting function as well. All right, so vitamin K can overcome the effects of coumarin. So if you're on that anticoagulation therapy, you got to be really concerned about your diet and just make sure that you take the same amount of vitamin K in your everyday meals so that your coumarin levels can be adjusted properly. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so warfarin, I think, is the trade name for coumarin.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a nice, safe way of doing it. Maybe if somebody's really sophisticated and compliant, you can tell them you can have things like broccoli, but you got to have the exact amount every single day. Can't go up, can't go down. Okay. And, you know, that's tough to do. Okay, so the safest thing is just to cut it all out from your diet altogether, okay, because that will affect your clotting function as well. So it doesn't work by thinning blood. It interacts with your clotting function through those various enzymatic steps, right, that are all linked together. Yeah.
So why would doctors prescribe heparin
rather than coumarin? I'm not sure about the half-life and the excretion levels. I think it's just easier to titrate the proper level of clotting function suppression using coumarin compared to heparin.
So
I think heparin works a lot better. It's a lot speedier, but that just means it's more difficult to control on a day-to-day basis. So heparin might be good under some circumstances for acute situations, but for chronic situations, coumarin is going to be better tolerated. Sure, there's no interaction there. Yeah, so that might be a benefit in some circumstances. Yeah. Yeah, so that's your anticoagulation therapies, right, are interacting with that chart that shows the coagulation pathways. All right, so now we're going to move on to the heart and or circulations of the heart. And remember that you have two circulations in your body. And a nice way of relating to that is, how many sides does the heart have? How many sides does the heart have? Not valves, but you would say two, okay? And it's maybe a little bit confusing the way I posed the question to you, but what are the two sides? You got a right and left side. Of course, you got a front and back and top and bottom, but it's best to think right and left, okay? Because you have a right ventricle and a left ventricle, you got a right atrium and a left atrium, and those two sides participate in these two circulations. So the right side of the heart, namely the right ventricle, pumps blood through which of these two circulations? The right side of the heart pumps blood into the pulmonary trunk, right? So the right ventricle is supplying blood to the lungs, and the left side of the heart is pumping blood to everywhere else in your body, which is what we call the systemic circulation. So you should be able to, from anatomy, trace a drop of blood through all the different chambers of the heart as it passes all the different valves and through the major blood vessels. All right, so I don't want to go over that in here because that's just anatomy. So you got to remember this diagram right here. All right, so maybe I'll just review a couple things. What kind of blood vessel takes blood away from the heart? That's an artery, okay, irregardless of what kind of blood, whatever contents the blood is carrying, whether it's high in oxygen or low in oxygen. Any blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart, that's an artery. Whether it is colored in your book blue or red, it doesn't matter. If it's away from the heart, that's an artery. So what's a good definition for a vein? It's bringing blood back to the heart, right? And again, it's just the direction of blood flow, not the contents that are in blood. So again, we can find, so here's a blood vessel, and here's the direction of that arrow. So this is a, okay, it's bringing blood back to the heart, so it is a, it's a vein, all right? And this particular vein is colored blue. Why? Because it is low in oxygen. But here is another blood vessel, and it is bringing blood back to the heart, right? So what is that, an artery or a vein? It's still a vein because it's bringing blood back to the heart, but in this particular case, what's the state of oxygen in this blood? It is high. So you can't use that as a definition for artery or vein, right? Systemic arteries are high in oxygen, systemic veins are low, but in the pulmonary circulation, the situation is reversed, so the pulmonary artery is low in oxygen, but the pulmonary veins are high, and that makes perfect sense, right? So if we look at this pulmonary blood that's in this artery going to the lungs, why is it going to the lungs? To pick up oxygen, right? So it makes perfect sense, but you have to really pay attention and think about why that is, all right? And also in the lungs, blood gives up CO2, so these veins are, the pulmonary veins are low in carbon dioxide and relatively high in oxygen. All right, so that just leaves us with a third kind of blood vessel. We talked about arteries, which take blood away from the heart, and veins, which bring blood back to the heart. But these vessels, remember from anatomy, are very thick. They're way too thick to allow for exchange. There's only one kind of blood vessel that allows for exchange, and that is a capillaries. That's right. So you got systemic capillaries for exchange, and you got pulmonary capillaries for exchange. And why can exchange take place in a capillary? Because they're thin. It only has the endothelium. And of course, you remember that there are actually three kinds of capillaries depending on how leaky they are. We'll talk about those, I think, in this class, maybe just a little bit. All right, so make sure that, you know, if you put a drop of blood right here, you can say how it goes, where does exchange take place, what is the state of blood in these particular chambers, all right, particular blood vessels, and you got to know the valves. All right, so one question I ask anatomy students is, how many chambers does a heart have?
Four.
Four, right, and so you know the four chambers, and then a corollary to that is, how many valves are there? There are four as well. All right, so that's easy to remember. How many chambers?
Four.
How many valves? How many valves? There are four. And we can actually see all four valves here. There are two atrioventricular valves. I see we need a little bit of review. All right, there are two atrioventricular valves. Here's one on the right side of the heart. Here's the atrioventricular valve on the left. So go ahead and name the one on the right. Tricuspid, right? Try before you buy. So the one on the left is the bicuspid valve. And so that's two. How many more valves are you interested in knowing about? Two more, and they are at the root of the great arteries coming off the base of the heart. So here's the pulmonary trunk. So that means here is the pulmonary semilunar valve. Here is the aorta, ascending aorta, which means that this valve right here is the aortic semilunar valve. So you got two atrioventricular and two semilunar valves. Okay, so what's the job? This is a nice physiology question. What's the job of these valves? Yeah, prevent retrograde flow. So instead of saying backflow, that's okay, right? Or backflow or backward flow of blood, that's okay. Proper term is retrograde. Retrograde means going backwards. Anterograde means going forward. So the job of these valves is to make sure that blood flows in one direction through the heart. That's very important. Okay, and what happens if these valves don't function properly? What will happen to the heart? Well, it's going to die. It's going to kill the heart eventually, right? So that's a very serious pathology that has to be dealt with. When you have a valve that's not functioning properly, it has to be repaired. If it can't be repaired, it's got to be replaced. That's all there's to it. Okay, think of walking up a sand dune. Has anybody ever walked up or run up a sand dune? And what is that like? Well, going upstairs is tough, right? It's harder than going downstairs. But what about a sand dune? Every time you take a step up, what happens? You slide back down, right? And then you take another step up, and what do? You slide back down. So it's like 10 times the amount of effort on a sand dune, okay? And what would happen to you if somebody said you have to walk up this sand dune all day long? Not just 10 or 15 minutes worth of exercise, but all day long. What would happen? Well, that would kill you too, right? Okay, so that would kill you. So if the heart has a leaky valve, that would be like the heart walking up a sand dune, right, day after day after day, not just for 5 or 10 minutes, and eventually that will kill the heart. Okay, so that's got to be dealt with. Okay, one thing sometimes we don't pay a lot of attention to in anatomy is the fibrous skeleton of the heart. There is a connective tissue layer between the atria and the ventricles. And one thing that you know from muscles is that muscles can act a lot like nerves. Because what's the kind of channel that a muscle has that nerves have too? That allows an action potential to be propagated over the whole surface of a muscle fiber cell. It has, okay, and axons have these things. What can an axon do that a dendrite can't do? Okay, yeah, an action potential, because axons have voltage-gated channels. Remember, dendrites are the receiving end. They have ligand-gated channels. Well, even myocardial tissue, the cardiac muscle cells have voltage-gated channels, so they can propagate action potentials over their whole cell surface. But this fibrous skeleton is connective tissue. They don't have voltage-gated channels, so an action potential can't go normally from an atria into a ventricle except through one particular pathway that we're going to look at when we get to the conduction system of the heart. So this fibrous skeleton is really important because it electrically isolates the atria from the ventricles, and we're going to see why that's important. Another important reason for this fibrous skeleton is because it's really tough, and in that fibrous skeleton there is the annuli fibrosi, and these are the places where all four valves attach themselves. So all four valves, even though on this slide right here, they don't look like they're all in one plane. They look like they're in different locations in the heart, but actually there is just one plane separating the atria from the ventricles that all these valves attach to, and that stabilizes the valves. It also prevents the valves from dilating. Remember, the flaps, what do we call the flaps of a valve? Those are cusps, right? And those cusps have to approximate and touch each other in order to close. And if a valve starts to dilate, what happens to the cusps? They can't touch each other, and then the valve is going to leak, and then what's going to happen? It's going to kill the heart. And then, of course, it's going to kill the individual. All right, so the fibrous skeleton just makes sure that the leaflets still can touch each other and close properly. So those are some important functions of the fibrous skeleton. And I do have one little picture, sorry, right here that shows the fibrous skeleton between the atria and ventricles, right? So that's important for you to know. Okay. All right, so I think all these slides that I have right here just go over the circulations, which you got to just review on your own, but If you really want me to pester you about that, come see me during office hours and I can quiz you to make sure that you understand that circulation. Now here is something that we don't really talk about in anatomy, right? The right ventricle is pumping blood through the through the pulmonary circulation, and the left is pumping blood through the systemic circulation, and these circulations are kind of back to back. After blood flows through the pulmonary circulation, then the heart pumps it through the systemic circulation. So it's like a one really big loop. So what can you tell me about the amount of blood that the right ventricle pumps compared to the amount that the left ventricle pumps? Should it be the same? Should it match up? Or could one side of the heart pump more blood than the other? Okay. Okay, this is good that we're thinking about this. Okay. Because from anatomy, you remember that the left ventricle is really big and thick. Okay. And the right ventricle is kind of thin and wimpy. Okay, but the amount of blood, the blood flow between these two chambers right here has to match up. But the reason why the left ventricle is so much bigger and thicker is because it has to push a lot harder. So the pressure has to be a lot higher in the left side than the right side in order to get the same amount of blood to flow through. All right, and that's because the distance that it flows through the pulmonary circulation is a lot less compared to the distance as it flows through the systemic circulation. And what can you tell me about the length of a blood vessel in terms of flow? What happens to a blood vessel as its length increases? I think you did this experiment in lab. Okay, as the length increases, what increases? The resistance increases. And to get the same flow through a higher resistance circuit, you need higher pressure. And since the systemic circulation is a lot longer, it has a lot more resistance, so it needs a lot more pressure to get blood to flow through it. Okay, so let's consider what happens if the flow through these two circulations is different. Let's just say that the left is pumping a lot more blood than the right. What's going to happen? Then blood is going, so you got a lot of blood going into these tissue capillaries right here, but if the right ventricle isn't pumping it, guess what? That blood is going to pool in the tissues. All right, so in order for the circulatory system to work properly, the flow between the left and right ventricle has to match up. Otherwise, blood is going to get stuck someplace, and that vessel is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually what's going to happen? It's going to blow up. That's sort of like a joke, okay? But nonetheless, it's a big problem, okay? It won't actually blow up, but it might under some circumstances. Okay, so the rate of flow through the systemic circulation must equal the rate of flow through the pulmonary circulation. Otherwise, it's going to back up someplace. And it's got to flow equally through both to the same degree. Low pressure, all right, in the pulmonary circulation, but high pressure in the systemic circulation because the resistance is higher. All right, so the resistance of the systemic circuit is what? Greater than pulmonary? So the work done by the left ventricle pumping to the systemic circulation is about 5 to 7 times greater. All right, so just think about if you were to lift two weights. You lift some weights with your right arm, but with your left arm, you're going to lift 7 times as much weight. Which arm is going to be stronger? Yeah, your left arm is going to be a lot stronger, right? It's hard to imagine actually 7 times greater. All right, so the left ventricle is much more muscular as a result of that. Okay, heart valves, make sure you know your heart valves, semilunar or atrioventricular valves compared to the semilunar valves. That's going to be important to know that. And how do these valves work? Let's talk about how these valves work. Why do they open and why do they close? Is there like a little motor in there that's making these things work, or why is it that they flap around? Okay. They work because of a pressure gradient. Okay, so how does a fluid flow? Yeah, that's exactly right. So a fluid is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. Okay, so let's look at this ventricle right here. Let's look at the right ventricle. Okay, if there's high pressure in the atrium and low pressure in the ventricle, blood is going to want to flow, into the ventricle. But as soon as there's high pressure in the ventricle compared to the atria, blood is going to want to go back into the right atrium, right? That's just a law of physics. All right, but as blood is flowing, it gets behind this cusp right here, right, and it snaps it closed, all the cusps, these three cusps in the tricuspid valve. When blood starts to go retrograde from the ventricle into the atria, it causes the flaps to approximate each other and close. So there's no muscle that's really causing these flaps to touch each other. It's just the retrograde flow of blood that moves them back. All right, so it's just a passive device. Closing of a valve is passive, and then when the pressure is higher in the atrium compared to the ventricle, the valves open up. Again, it's a passive mechanism. It's just the blood flow will move into the ventricle, opening up these leaflets right here. And that's the same for the semilunar valves compared to the atrioventricular valves. It's a passive mechanism that is determined by the pressure gradient, which then determines which way blood is flowing. Okay, and you might say, well, when blood starts to flow back from a ventricle into an atrium, what prevents this valve from inverting altogether? Because it would do that, except for some structures on that AV valve. It's prevented from flopping back up into the atria because on the margins of the cusps or the leaflets right here, there are chorda tendineae, and the chorda tendineae are attached to these little papillary muscles that look like little fingertips, right? So these muscles right here put tension on the valve so they can't flip back altogether, all right? And if they did, then it would leak. All right, so valves open and close just due to the pressure gradient across them. And all valves will work that way. Okay, cardiac cycle. So if you're not familiar with those cardiac valves, you got to go back and look at them. Or come see me during office hours and I can pester you a little bit about those valves. All right, but basically, take home message, how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have?
Four.
And you got to be familiar with those four valves. All right, cardiac cycle is a repeating pattern of contraction and relaxation. The heart is a pump. A lot of pumps we're familiar with are electric motor driven, and you turn that motor on and it pumps continuously, okay? But your heart doesn't pump blood continuously. It's what we call a reciprocating pump. Sometimes it is actually pumping blood, and at other times it's not pumping blood. So sometimes it's pumping, sometimes it's relaxing because it's a muscle. The periods of time when it is contracting, we call that systole. And other periods of time when it's relaxing, we call that diastole. So those are the two main phases that make up the cardiac cycle, right? The contraction phase and relaxation phase, and you got to know exactly which one is which, right? Diastole is relaxation. So when the heart is pumping, can you imagine that that's when there is the highest pressure in a blood vessel, when it's actually pumping blood? And then when the heart starts to relax, guess what happens to the pressure in an artery? It starts to drop, right? So pressure is variable in a blood vessel coming from the heart. So that's why sometimes when we take blood pressure, well, not sometimes, but every time when we measure blood pressure, how many numbers do we get? We get two. One refers to the peak pressure, which is the systolic pressure. That's right after the heart contracts. And then the lowest is diastole. That's right at the end when the heart is completely relaxed, right? So the pressure goes up and then it goes down. And so normal blood pressure, normal systemic blood pressure is about 120 millimeters of mercury over 80. And both of those numbers are important. Which one is the diastolic number? 80, right? That's during relaxation. So it's systolic over diastolic. Okay, now both atria contract simultaneously together, and that's followed about a tenth of a second or two-tenths of a second later by contraction of the ventricles. So the heart has to contract like that, which I think probably makes perfect sense. If we go backwards right here and look at a picture of the heart, what's the job of the atria? To pump blood into the ventricles, right? And so the atria should pump blood first because that helps load the ventricles up with volume, right? The ventricle can't pump any blood unless there is blood in the ventricle to pump, right? Okay, so the atria help load blood into the ventricles, and after it does, then the ventricles can do their job by contracting and pump blood up into the great arteries coming off the base of the heart. Okay, so that is important. And we're going to look at the conduction system to see how that actually happens. Now, the pulmonary circuit, what did we say, is not nearly as high in resistance. To get the same blood flow, it needs a lower pressure, or it doesn't require as high a pressure. And notice that pressure is about 25 millimeters of mercury over 10 to go from the ventricle back up into the atria. So the right ventricle doesn't have to contract to the same degree. There are some parameters that we like to understand about a heart to know how well it is doing its job. And there are some important volumes. End-diastolic volume is the volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. So we call that what? The end-diastolic volume. And then there's an end-systolic volume. That's the amount of blood that's left in the ventricles at the end of systole. Now, what is systole again? That's the contraction phase. Okay, so which one of these volumes, end-diastolic volume or end-systolic volume, is the larger volume? Or should they be the same? Which is the larger volume? Okay, and it's I don't mean it to be a trick question, but it's tricky until you think about it. Okay, so diastole is what? Contraction. What happens to the size of a ventricle when it contracts? It gets smaller, and right at the end of systole, that's actually the smallest volume inside the heart. And then what happens? It starts to fill up with blood again during relaxation, which is what? Diastole. And as it fills up, what happens to the volume of a ventricle? Yeah, it gets bigger, right? So the end diastolic volume is the larger of the two, and that should be the largest volume of the ventricle, and end systolic volume should be the smallest. And the heart doesn't pump every drop of blood that's in a ventricle. There's always going to be some left over in the ventricle. So the end systolic volume is, you're always going to have some volume there. Okay. Now, stroke volume is just the difference in the diastolic compared to systolic. So it's end diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. That's the amount of amount of blood that the heart pumps out every time it contracts. We call that stroke volume. Okay, so the volume of the ventricle at the end of diastole is not equal to the amount of blood that it pumps out, because at the end of systole, there's always going to be some blood left in that ventricle. Okay, so here is a couple good questions. Which is larger, end-systolic volume or end-diastolic volume? End-diastolic volume, because that's when the heart fills up. Now look at your notes, and I think there's a typo in your notes. It says, which is larger, end-systolic volume or end-systolic volume? Or end-diastolic and end-diastolic? Okay, make sure you change it so that you know that there's two different volumes there. Okay, what is stroke volume? Now you should be able to calculate this. What is the stroke volume if the end systolic volume is 20 mLs and the end diastolic is 80? You probably don't need a calculator for that. Okay, that is just what? 60. It's just one minus the other, and that's 60 mLs. Okay, so these calculations are pretty easy to do. Some maybe aren't quite so easy to do, but that one's a really easy one. Okay, as the ventricles contract, well, I tell you what, one thing before we go to this slide. All right, what are the two phases of the cardiac cycle? Those are the two circulations, but in terms of the cardiac cycle, the phases of the cardiac cycle, you've got contraction, which is systole, and relaxation, which is diastole. All right, and for decades, people were very interested in systolic function of the heart, the contraction of the heart, to understand something about high blood pressure or cardiovascular disease. That's where the emphasis was always placed, on the systolic function of the heart. And as the heart got weaker, it couldn't contract as much, right? That caused problems for individuals. And we ignored the diastolic function of the heart. What's the diastolic function of the heart? The relaxation of it, right? And now people are just as interested in diastolic function, because if the heart doesn't relax, okay, then it can't fill with blood, and if there's not enough blood in the heart, if you have proper systolic function, maybe the heart contracts with the right amount of vigor, but if there's no blood there, then it can't pump. So we have to be concerned about diastolic function as well as systolic function. They're both as important. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to show you, I think, this diagram right here first. Okay, and then we're going to go back and maybe talk about this slide a little bit. Okay, so here is a really nifty slide, and the one the slide that you have like this that's in your lab book is the one I really like the most. And there are some JPEGs or something in Blackboard where you can download the one that's in your lab book and practice labeling it. And that is the one that's actually the exam figure, not this one right here. All right, so you should be able to label everything on that diagram. And I modified the one in Blackboard just a little bit so that it makes just a little bit more sense than the one that's in your lab book. And did you do that lab yet already this semester or not?
No.
Okay, so you're going to be doing that sometime soon. This is what we call a Wiggers diagram. And it's a plot of various physiologic parameters versus time. So there's a time axis over here. So what are some of these physiologic parameters that we're going to be looking at? One that you might be sort of familiar with is the electrical activity in the heart versus time. And that's what we call the electrocardiogram. What do you call that instrument that can make an electrocardiogram? Yeah, EKG, and that's pretty close. It's called the electrocardiograph. The graph is the machine, and the thing that the machine makes is a gram. Okay, so years ago, how did people talk to each other from one side of the United States to the other? Is with a telegraph, all right? So the telegraph is the instrument that makes the telegram. Okay, same thing for this electrocardiograph and electrocardiogram. So here we have an electrocardiogram, and it's got a bunch of different bumps right here that we're going to look at. All right, so it's just the electrical activity of the heart versus time. Here's the first wave right here. That first wave is what we call the P wave. It's labeled right here. I don't really know why it was labeled the P wave, but I got a wild guess. Probably what? That's the primavera wave, right? Like the first event, right? The first wave on the heart. And then what happens after, what's the letter after P? Well, then Q. So here's another little bump, and there's the R and S. So we call this the QRS complex. And then here is the T wave, and it just follows the S. So what we see is the electrical events on the heart, and with the same time axis, we can compare it with the noise that the heart is making, right? The heart sounds. And the heart contracts with a tremendous amount of vigor. It produces a tremendous amount of pressure, which is going to cause those valves to just snap closed, and when they hit each other like that, they make a lot of noise. I can't quite hear it without a stethoscope, but they're so loud you can almost hear it without a stethoscope. But if you put your ear on somebody's chest, you can hear it quite easily. All right, so we have, I want you to know at least these first two heart sounds and why they happen. They happen because valves are closing, but you have to know which ones. And in order to know that, we need to know the pressure between the atria and the ventricles, because remember we said that these valves right here open or close because of pressure changes between an atria and a ventricle, or between an artery and a ventricle if it's a semilunar valve. So fortunately, we have a plot right here of pressure, and we can see zero pressure right here, and then 120 up on the top over here. What's 120? That should be normal systolic pressure in normal individuals, right? Zero we'll find in some parts of the cardiovascular system. But in a systemic artery, what would be the diastolic pressure? 80, right? So a normal person would have 120 over 80 right here. So this is just a plot of blood pressure versus time, and it's all justified correctly in time to match up with the heart sound and the ECG. And then the last graph that we have is the volume of a ventricle versus time. And again, it's all justified, rectified in time with the phonocardiogram and the electrical activity of the heart and the pressure of these various chambers, so that we can relate this to, oh, what can we relate this to? What did we just get done talking about? We talked about volumes of the ventricle. What were the two important volumes? End diastolic and systolic volume, right? And so maybe we should just start right there. Let's look at the volume of a ventricle. Okay, and let's just say left ventricle versus time. And what did we say the end diastolic volume was? Was that the largest volume or the smallest? That was the largest. So where's the largest volume here? Yell when I get there. Yeah, right here. Right, so if we bring this over, that's, you know, maybe about 130 mLs. That's about the largest. And what's the lowest volume? I don't know what it is right here. What does that say? I don't know what that number, it got clipped off. I don't know, is that a 50? Is that a 50? That's probably a 50. Okay, so maybe 60 mLs, okay, right there. So that would be the end systolic volume. But furthermore, you could just label this peak right here what? End diastolic volume, and label this right here end systolic volume. All right, well, let's just say it's 50. Let's just say it's 50. Now, how could you calculate stroke volume? It would be, yeah, it would be this 130 minus 50. That would be the amount of blood that's pumped by the heart every time it does what? Every time it contracts. All right, that would be the stroke volume. All right, so we see volume changes in the ventricles right here. And we can look at pressure. Where is the peak pressure at? In this blue line, I hope this is a blue. This is the pressure that we see in the ventricle. Okay, it's about right here. This is the peak pressure right here. And notice that the pressure in the ventricle actually goes from zero to systolic pressure. All right, and this line right here represents pressure in a systemic artery like the aorta. And notice that blood pressure doesn't go to zero, right? It just goes to the what we call the diastolic pressure, and that's really good because if it did go to zero, what would happen to you? Well, you would pass out until your heart contracted again, right? So it doesn't have time to go to zero, hopefully, in you, because what happens? The ventricle contracts again. And what is ventricular contraction controlled by? What's the signal for contraction? The electrical events on the heart. Okay. And you, I think, have studied this already in terms of skeletal muscle, either in the simulation or maybe in your own muscles. Did you contract muscles of your lab partners? Did you stimulate them and it caused a muscle contraction? Okay. Or at least on the simulator, you stimulated a muscle, all right, electrically, but did the muscle contract immediately? Did it contract immediately? You could measure the stimulation and then at a later time measure the force of contraction. What did you call that period of time between stimulation and when the muscle actually contracted? Latency period. That's right. How could you explain that latency period? Because it takes time for calcium to diffuse out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum around all the myofibrils, bind to what molecule? Troponin. And then tropomyosin has to get out of the way. Cross bridges have to link up with each other, right? So there's a lot of mechanical things and diffusion that has to take place between the signal and when the muscle actually starts to contract, and that's the latency period. Same thing for this ECG. The signal for contraction is the QRS complex, at least in the ventricles. But notice that is not synonymous with contraction. It takes a little while for the heart muscle to actually contract. There's a latency period, and again, it's explained by the same mechanism. There has to be diffusion of the calcium out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum or from the interstitial fluid into the cardiac muscle cell. The cross bridges have to form, so that takes a little bit of time. The ECG is not contraction. It is the signal for contraction. The way I think of that is maybe you're at a stoplight. Maybe you're the first car right at an intersection and the light's red. So what are you doing? You're just waiting, right? You're not moving through the intersection, hopefully. All right, and then the light turns green. But as the light turns green, where are you? You're still stopped right there. That's just the signal that you can proceed with caution, right? So the stoplight is the signal, but your motion through the intersection is a totally different thing. There's a latency between the two, like what? Well, you got to take your foot off the brake. Gas pedal, the car's got to do its thing, right? So the ECG is just a signal of the electrical events, which is the signal for contraction right here. Not exactly the same. Okay. Let's look at these pressure curves right here. We said that blood will flow from one place to another based on a pressure gradient. And which way will blood flow? High to low. So we're going to look at what's high and what's low. Here we have, and maybe this is a nice color right here, and I can't see, it just looks like gray. It is gray. Good. This is the pressure in the atrium, and you see it's then superimposed on pressure in the ventricle. Right at this point in time, there's higher pressure in the atrium than there is in the ventricle, so which way is blood flowing? It's flowing from the atria into the ventricle, because there's higher pressure in the atria, right? And does that make sense? Does that show up on the volume curve? If blood is flowing from the atria to the ventricle, what's happening to the volume of the ventricle? It should be increasing. And is it increasing on this Wiggers diagram? Indeed it is. That is really a good thing. Okay. Then comes along the signal for contraction. And the ventricles start to contract, and that pressurizes blood inside the ventricles, and now the pressure in the ventricle is higher than the atria right here. Which way is blood going to want to flow? From the ventricle into the atria, but what's stopping it? There's a valve right there. As a matter of fact, what kind of valve? You got two choices, semilunar or AV. That's the AV, atrioventricular valve. All right, so that pressure difference causes that valve to close, which makes what? A sound. The first heart sound is when the AV valve closes, and that's at the beginning of what phase of the cardiac cycle? That's the beginning of systole. So the first heart sound happens when the AV valve closes, right at the beginning of systole. Now, at this point in time, the AV valve is closed, and there's higher pressure in the aorta than the ventricle, so blood is going to want to flow from the aorta back into the ventricle, but can it?
No.
What's there? There's a semilunar valve there, right? The aortic semilunar valve. So at this time, between these two vertical bars, both the AV valve is closed and the aortic semilunar valve is closed. So if both of those valves are closed and the ventricles start to contract, what happens to the volume of a ventricle when it contracts, but all the doorways to the ventricle are closed? Blood can't go anywhere. So what about the size of the ventricle as it's contracting when all the valves are closed? It cannot change, right? It can't change. So this period from here to here is what we call a period of isovolumetric contraction. That means the volume can't change because all the valves are closed. And does the volume curve show that? Look, the volume isn't changing right here. It's shortened up a little bit because the heart started to contract, but as soon as that AV valve closes, the volume of the heart can't change because all the doors are closed. All right. But the ventricle keeps contracting. The pressure keeps building and building and building, and then it gets to this point right here. Now we have higher pressure in the ventricle compared to the aorta, and so what happens? The semilunar valve opens, blood will flow from a ventricle into the aorta because there's now higher pressure in the ventricle than the aorta, so it's going to move from the heart into the aorta. And so then what happens to the size of the ventricle as blood is leaving the ventricle and entering the aorta? It starts to decrease, right? So it goes from end diastolic volume all the way down to end systolic volume right here. All right, so this is a particularly excellent diagram, all right, not to just practice your graph reading skills, but to really understand what's happening inside the heart. And fortunately, we can still talk a little bit more today about it. Okay, so as blood flows from the aorta, no, from the ventricle into the aorta, look what happens to the pressure inside the aorta. It increases, okay, and then the heart kind of runs out of blood to pump, even though it's still contracting, but there's no longer a lot of blood in the ventricle to pump, so the pressure starts to decrease, okay, until you get down to this point right here. And the pressure in the aorta starts to decrease a little bit, and at this point, now there's what? A lot more pressure in the aorta than the ventricle, so which way is blood going to go? It's going to go from high to low, so from the aorta into the ventricle, but aha, can it? No, what's stopping it? The aortic semilunar valve closes right at this point. So this graph right here isn't drawn exactly right, but this blue line should be brought over to right about at this point here before it drops, but it's close enough. All right, so for here, right now, where the cursor is, you can see that pressure in the aorta is greater than the ventricle. That's going to close the semilunar valves. And what does a valve do when it closes? It makes a racket, right? So it makes a sound right here, and what is that? That is the second heart sound. So the first heart sound is when the AV valve closes at the beginning of systole. The second heart sound happens because of closure of the semilunar valve, which happens during what? The beginning of diastole, when blood tries to flow back from the aorta into the ventricle right here. Okay, so I'm sure you had some questions regarding that, those valves. All right, then the pressure inside the ventricle continues to decrease, and we see now it gets lower than the pressure in the atria. So what happens? Which way does blood flow between the atria and ventricle now? Back into the ventricle from an atria. So what has to open up at that point in time? The AV valve has to open right here, and it does easily, right? And it opens up, doesn't necessarily make much of a heart sound. Certainly in a normal heart, it doesn't make a sound. Valves really don't make much sounds when they open up unless there's something wrong with them. So now blood starts to flow from an atria into the ventricle because there's higher pressure in the atria than ventricle. So what happens to the volume of the ventricle at this point in time? It starts to go up. So this is now filling of the heart during diastole because there's higher pressure in the atria than the ventricle. And then the cycle does what? Repeats itself over and over and over again. The only thing that I didn't mention is this little dip in the aortic pressure curve right where the aortic semilunar valve closes. Okay, and that's because, all right, in order for that semilunar valve to close, blood actually has to flow and what? Inflate the cusps. So it flows back just a little bit, and that causes this little transient dip in blood pressure right there that we call the dicrotic notch. Is that labeled on here? No. But it's maybe labeled on your other Wiggers diagram that you have. Dicrotic notch is caused by closing of the aortic semilunar valve because it takes a little pressure to inflate those cusps in order for them to approximate each other. Okay, so that explains the heart sounds. All right, that shows that the ECG precedes contraction, okay, because of a latency period. The only other thing that I didn't talk about is the big difference between this P wave and the QRS over here. The P wave is the signal for contraction of atria, and the QRS is the signal for contraction of the ventricles. So when you look at the ECG, right, can you tell that the atria contract at a different time than the ventricles? Because the signal is different, right? So this P wave represents atrial depolarization, which is what? Excitatory. That's an excitatory event in cells. The QRS represents depolarization of the ventricles. Now, what do cells have to do before they can depolarize again? They've got to repolarize. That's right. Okay. And the T wave right here represents repolarization of the ventricles only. So you might be asking, where is repolarization of the atria? It happens at the exact same time that the ventricles depolarize. So it's embedded in this signal right here. But since the atria are really dinky structures, they're very thin muscles, they don't contribute a lot to the ECG. Notice how small this P wave is right here compared to the QRS. So that when repolarization of the atria is superimposed on the QRS complex completely obliterates that signal. You can't see it. And in an everyday circumstance, I think you can appreciate that. So if you go outside right now, there's no clouds in the sky. And are there any stars up in the sky? There are, but you can't see them. Why can't you see them? Because the sun is so bright that you can't see them. Same thing for repolarization of the atria. That signal is so small compared to this huge signal from the ventricles, you just can't see it. It's in there, unless you can somehow block that signal from the ventricles, but I wouldn't recommend it, because if you don't have this signal right here, what's not going to happen? The ventricles aren't going to contract, right? So I wouldn't volunteer for that experiment. Okay, so you have two periods of isovolumetric happenings inside the heart. They always happen when both valves are closed. When the AV valve and semilunar valve is closed, one is a period of isovolumetric contraction when the ventricles contract, and this other period is isovolumetric relaxation between, right, when the valves open. Okay. So isovolumetric means that all the valves are closed and blood can't enter or leave the ventricles because of that. All right, so this is a really good diagram, and you got to practice labeling your Wiggers diagram that you have in lab. Okay, so we talked about heart sounds already. It kind of sounds like a loved up first and second sound. That's all I want you to remember. So next time, probably we're going to start here with heart murmurs. All right, and then hopefully finish up this chapter really, really fast. Review the conduction system of the heart from anatomy. All right, because I probably won't go over that next time. I'll just tell you the physiologic significance of the conduction system. Okay.